Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's badlandsranch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's our pleasure to talk about the offense from that Giants game on Sunday, doing that with Gabe Ferguson, my good friend. Gabe, how you doing?
Hey, Ken. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show again. Looking forward to talking about a really fun offensive performance, and I guess I got a good week to come on the show.
Yeah, boy, you did. Incredible, efficient day for Lamar Jackson. 21 out of 25, a near-perfect passer rating. Passer rating, four categories it's in, and he maxed out three of them. The one he didn't was at yards per reception. I believe he's a little below the mark necessary for that, but he hit all the other maxes for interceptions, for touchdowns, and for completion percentage. So that was the one he fell a little short on. We talked about how the Ravens played this Giants team on the defense show a fair amount. And the guest there was Ed Norris, really thought that he felt the need to say, but it was the Giants, to just about every single good thing the Ravens did in this game. And I guess I would kind of turn it back on you. I'm very positive about this result exceeding expectations. I mean, do you ever win one game, even one game, in every way that you, but by hitting every single mark you thought you would? I thought this game basically hit it in every way, but except for the penalty total.
Yeah, the penalties were definitely frustrating, but I think they came out and showed exactly what I wanted to see from them against, an inferior opponent. It is true, the Giants were not a great team coming out of the bye week, but it was also on the road. It was a road game. It wasn't optimal conditions outside in a poor stadium. So it wasn't necessarily like a perfect environment to have, a huge offensive performance, but I think they definitely checked the boxes. The first couple drives were a little clunky, but after that it was five straight touchdown drives. So that's kind of just that idea of when this offense kind of finds its groove, it really does look like probably the best offense in football. And I think they showed that on the Sunday's game against the Giants.
Yeah, it really was. That trend that you're mentioning was fantastic. So they had fumble on the first drive by Lamar after two plays. And they're both those plays were big gains. Then they passed up that fourth and one. And I want to come back to that a little later. It deserves its own segment on the show in terms of doing that, but really bad decision, I thought. Then they were unstoppable with five straight touchdowns. And then the backups were in all of a sudden. So Lamar really led them on five straight touchdown drives, but also that fourth and one, we're going to come back to it. I think they should have continued that drive, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But I want to get back to the notion of it was the Giants. Because you just said it too, but it was the Giants. Yes, an inferior team on the road. And I think a lot of people feel the need to say that. The Ravens, the way they played yesterday, and I'm not just talking about the results they got because they were facing the Giants team, but the way they played yesterday, they would have beaten any team in the National Football League if that team is having an average day. Now, if Buffalo was playing great, or the Lions are in a great game, or even the Steelers were having a great game, maybe they could have given the Ravens a game, you know, based on how they played. But the Ravens, outstanding game that they played against the Giants.
Yeah, and I think there's a number of players that had nice games or high quality games, and I think we'll talk about them more in detail. But real quick, I do want to highlight Lamar Jackson because, and you mentioned, you know, his super efficient game, but he made a lot of plays, yes, against the Giants defense, but it's an NFL defense that they're not standing around giving up, you know, free wide open receivers. And he threaded the needle on a number of throws, several touchdowns, plays where he was on the move, pressure in his face. It didn't matter on Sunday. He was putting the ball wherever he wanted it. And that's the main reason why the Ravens offense looked so good, because Lamar Jackson was on top of his game. And it was like a perfect crisp performance that we've seen from him in the past. And when he plays at that level, I agree with you. I don't think any team can actually stop that.
I'm going to add an adjunct point to that. It's not really a counterpoint, but I'm going to say it wasn't just Lamar Jackson. And the reason the player I'll highlight is Bateman. Mm-hmm. Bateman had an unbelievable day as a receiver. He got open on all five of his targets by a wide amount. And two of them were incomplete and both Lamar's fault, which is incredible. You go 21 of 25 and you still leave two throws on the field like that. But the first one, the second one was a pass out to the right sideline where Lamar just threw it. It was a little bit off balance. He threw it kind of between two receivers. Looked like it was a very dangerous throw, but Bateman was wide open. He would have probably had 10, 11, 12 yards if he'd have caught that ball. And the other one, of course, was thrown up very short for Bateman on a really Lamar's very poor throw of the day. It's a possible interception. And it really should have been a touchdown to Bateman. He really just needed to throw the ball to the goal line instead of to the 10-yard line. And he had him. Could have thrown him open very easily on that play. But you look at that game and Bateman making space, even if some of that was coverage breakdown related, is still remarkable. And Lamar, of course, did his part in all that and obviously had a fantastic day, but the second touchdown to Bateman in particular, I thought was just an outstanding throw by Lamar. That was probably, for my money, his best throw of the game. Actually, there were two. The Bateman touchdown and the Walker touchdown were both outstanding small window throws, largely because of the amount of space that was in the end zone around them.
Yeah, I would also say there was the throw to Nelson Aguilar was also really impressive.
Yeah, off balance.
It was an off balance, kind of like off platform throw, right on the money, exactly where it needed to be. So he made a number of those type of throws. He didn't make every throw, like you said, but give credit to the wide receivers. I mean, I think I saw a statistic from Pro Football Focus about separation. Zay Flowers and Rashad Bateman were number two and number three in separation created. For week 15.
Yeah.
I will say the Giants, they had, I think, some practice squad players, and they had some injuries in the secondary, but it wasn't like, you know, they're still playing coverage. Like, they're not just like out there standing around. Like, it wasn't a completely like ineffective defense, and they were just very good in how they were creating separation, running their routes. I think it was a good offensive scheme. I think that was a big part of it. That's the play calls, you know, the way they were designed to attack the defense that was there. That's whenever you see like those kind of separation stats, it's not always just going to be, you know, the wide receiver making plays. It's also the way that the that is designed for how the routes, the route combinations to attack certain defenses, that's going to create those opportunities for the receivers as well. So great job by Todd Monken in that instance.
Yeah, I that was really relevant, or really evident, I should say, on the Walker touchdown play, which was designed exactly for, I think it was Flowers, to draw off the safety in that case. And no one went with Walker. And apparently they'd been practicing it during the week. And they said, you know, you're going to score on that play kind of thing. And sure enough, ball's right on the money. It's really nice to have, you know, that high velocity, low trajectory throw that was really needed on that for a long pass. I mean, it's still some arc to it, but it is lower trajectory than you might others have. It wasn't a moon ball, for example, where Walker was able to, you know, still catch it in stride right at the end line, toe tap and celebrate.
Yeah. I mean, it's good to see him actually get on the field. He made a nice special teams play earlier that potentially saved a big return, and his first NFL catch to be a touchdown. You know, kudos to Tez Walker.
Yeah. Great game. Great game indeed. Great, first pass catch. All right. Let's talk about some other things here. Dominant offensive line performance. We'll talk about later. They avoided injuries on that MetLife turf, I should say. That is always a big one. Whenever they go into that crappy stadium, you don't want to get hurt. It used to be Philadelphia, Pittsburgh had, you know, some of those qualities about it. The old 1970s baseball stadiums in particular. So that's Three Rivers and Pittsburgh, and used to be Busch Stadium in St. Louis had a reputation for this back when the Cardinals used to play there. They were just nightmarish plays to go in and trip over some of the Vet, you know, the old Vet, just terrible places. This MetLife's a new stadium. There's no excuse for it, but they've had a lot of injury problems there.
Yeah. That's one of the big wins always for a team. Stay healthy, and especially, you know, end of the year. You know, the Ravens had a good opportunity to come off a bye, coming out very healthy. Late bye, I think, is beneficial to playoff teams. So they're poised to be able to make one of those runs because they are one of the healthier teams in the NFL right now.
Yeah, you look at the Steelers injury report for this week, and they've got 7 DNPs. The Ravens have Aguilar, who I guess he got concussed on the play, though. Sure didn't look like it from the view of him immediately after on the sideline. He was having fun celebrating his big catch, but it looked like on that 26-yard throw, he came down on the back of his head, and maybe there's a concussion involved. So I'm sure the DNP relates to, I would guess the DNP relates to that.
Yeah, most likely. I do remember when after that play, he did come off, he motioned that he needed to come out. So he must have felt something not completely right at that time. So hopefully not too serious, but we'll see how the Ravens handle the wide receiver 3 position moving forward.
All right. And of course, big news, we get Aaron Schatz producing the DeVoa rankings today. And a bunch of things came out about that. The Ravens, first of all, moved up to number 1 overall in terms of DVOA. And we've got a question about this from that I want to just address right now, since we're talking about this, we don't have to go back to it in the mailbag. But this came originally from Priya Kurtz, who says, this is in regards to DVOA chart posted by Aaron Schatz. Would you mind breaking it down further? Okay, well, sure thing. So DVOA is defensive value over average. First of all, you have an offensive number, which it's good to be positive. And the Ravens have the best offense in the National Football League, and they're about a 37%. No, they're about a 34% DVOA. And then they're about 2 or 3% positive also on defense. Although if you see that in a chart, the defense, a negative number is good. So they look something like -2 and change or thereabouts, which puts them in the top 13 or so in the National Football League. I would say most of what's holding the Ravens back at this point was what happened early in the year, which I don't see the relevance of now that, you know, Marcus Williams and Eddie Jackson aren't on the field anymore. That defense is a lot better. Yep. It's also a lot better with the return of Michael Pierce, which you talked about a fair amount on the defensive show.
Yeah, I think one of the comments in the article by Aaron Schatz is that a big part of where the Ravens have improved in terms of the overall DVOA ranking is in the fact that their defense has improved steadily over the past few weeks. So the offense has been consistently very exceptionally good this entire season, but the defense was kind of holding them back from being like that clear cut number one team. Now the defense is kind of returning to the form that we would expect to see, like to see from a Ravens defense. It's bringing the whole overall rating to that point. I also think the special teams perhaps has come up a little bit. I know earlier in this year, they were like either dead last or next to dead last in special teams. Clearly there's still some issues there with the missed kicks. But I think in general, we're seeing some improvement, in some areas as well. Some of the kick returns we're seeing are improving. Coverage as well is getting better. There have been a lot of lapses in special teams, so if that can kind of also be improved and brought to like its apex at this time of year, that's something we'd like to see.
Yeah, you one area where I think the Ravens have been actually pretty good, or it seems like they've been relatively good, is the opponents have been penalized a little bit more on special teams recently. Okay, so both return games are working out. So they've had, you know, three or four good returns now over the last, what, 2 or 3 weeks. And those plays haven't had a penalty on them, which, you know, it's a little bit unusual. You can have four good returns in a row with no penalty, say. They've had some different guys doing it. So we've seen Desmond King replacing Tylan Wallace on punt returns. And we've seen Justice Hill make a big return in this game. And somebody else had a big return too. It wasn't Mitchell. I think it was Ali, right? Had a big kickoff return.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I completely agree with you on that. I think Stout is also rooting the ball right now. It's not necessarily getting the number of in-10s that we expected from his draft. You know, that was the big thing about Jordan Stout, was he had this great record of in-10 punts. And he hasn't shown that at all at the NFL level, but he's shown the big leg, you know, that I don't know that we knew we were getting when we drafted him.
Yeah, all right. So... I mean, just real quick, just to get back to the DVOA, though, having the Ravens number one with the 9-5 record, I think is a little bit, you know, some people might question that and say, like, mm-hmm. how are they the best team? But it really does go to back to what the DVOA ranking is. And you said, you know, it's a composite of your offensive performance and your defensive performance. And it's weighted against the average of every single play that happens in the NFL. And yes, it is also weighted against your opponent. So if you're going against consistently better teams, you're going to have a better strength of victory, or, you know, versus, you know, having or better play by play results versus a stronger opponent. That goes into the overall rating. And the Ravens, they've had a decently tough schedule. It hasn't been like, it's pretty middle of the pack. And the other thing that's, I think, important to point out is that while, you know, DVOA does include some things like turnovers and penalties in their rating, not all of them are considered. And like fumbles, for instance, it weights it as like a 50-50 chance of it being lost or recovered. So some of those.
So like, if you lose a fumble, it's really only kind of losing like half a fumble or 54% of a fumble or something.
Right. Like. So like teams that have more fumbles potentially could be part of like kind of like unluckiness. And that's not held against them in the same way that it might be in certain other stats, like just straight EPA, for instance.
Yeah, that's a good description. And there's a lot of wins and losses. So it kind of is a little more akin to success rate in terms of if you have successes on plays, those win you plays and they give you value there. It's not it's different from EPA in that sense, in that they're really trying to assess wins on plays. Also devalues plays at the end of games. So the last two drives when they're just running Rasheen Ali, all but one of those plays, that wouldn't even pretty much counted in the thing at all. It would at least have been substantially down weighted. Yep. And we've seen Buffalo, for example, playing some games right to the end the last couple of weeks where they're still, you know, trying to score points at the end of very high scoring affairs. And, you know, a team shouldn't benefit from that relative thing, or put more accurately, a Ravens team that's ahead in the game shouldn't lose from trying to get the game over with. And that's a very important reason why I'm not the hugest fan of EPA in general. I like win probability added because I think that's what you're playing for in the second half of a game. We do have a good win probability example coming up for you a little later, Priya. But the other thing that you asked about, I think, was the Aaron Schatz choice is really looking at the best teams ever that have been 9-5. And the Ravens are the best ever 9-5 team since DVOA has been calculated. And they're up there at, you know, 37% or whatever. And they showed the other 9-5 teams which have gone to the Super Bowl. And there are 14 of them, I believe. They're 9-4 in terms of winning the Super Bowl, the ones that have gone there. And guess who's included in that group? The 2012 Ravens. And but it was also pointed out to me, and I had not picked up on this at the exact at the point this was mentioned to me, but the 2012 Ravens shared a very significant factor with the 2024 Ravens. I mean, they were just bottom of the barrel in terms of being penalized, third worst in the entire NFL. And you know, it's just I'm not, to be crystal clear about this, I'm not saying that's the way to build your franchise, is to not be at all concerned about penalties. I'm just saying it's not a disqualifying factor if you have a high penalty total, because the context of it is still fairly small in total. Okay. The total context of penalties in terms of yards relative to other things, and in terms of first downs, even relative to total other things, it's not that much. And when you add to that, I'm sorry, I missed my point here. Just looking at the fact that teams like the 2012 Ravens won the Super Bowl despite it, or teams like the 1970s Raiders did it. The thing I would encourage people to do is don't make declarative statements relative to penalty totals. It's kind of like saying, well, the team that leads the league in bunt singles is never going to win a world championship, or a team that allows, you know, 15 more bunt singles than the next most team is never going to win a world championship. Well, sure, they well might. That's just not that high a context element.
Yeah, I mean, penalties can definitely be very frustrating in the moment when you see it happen and it extends a drive or, you know, brings back a big play. But I think, to your point, not all penalties are created equal, first of all. You know, some penalties are sometimes, you know, in place of a worse outcome if it wasn't for the penalty. And sometimes penalties are, you know, of no real result at all, or have very little impact. That's not to say it's something that I think the team can improve on. Like, I mean, generally speaking, being less penalized is a good thing, but it's not going to be the one thing that holds the team back.
I've got one other mathematical thing to add about this. The average football team in the NFL gets a first down a little bit over 2/3 of the time when they start a series of plays. So most defensive fouls, not all, you know, encroachment and offsides, they don't fall into this category, but most defensive fouls, they give the opponent an automatic first down. Think of it this way. They were probably going to get a first down anyway. So what you really gave them is a third of a first down, or 0.3 of a first down, above what their expectation was of getting one on that drive. And it can be frustrating as hell when it's 3rd and 5 and you know, there's a DPI on what would have been an incomplete pass. But, you know, most of the time when it happens, you're not giving away that much relative to what they would have expected to have. Offensive penalties on the offensive line in particular, or post-snap fouls, which allow a play to be reversed and changed to a penalty, even without a loss of down, those are the big additions to variance that can kill an offense. Yeah. They're much more serious in a lot of ways than even giving up a 5-yard defensive holding, which gives a first down. Frustrating as hell, but it just, in terms of its relative importance, it just doesn't have the kind of drive by drive impact on scoring or win probability that the offensive fouls that set you back and you know, grant the defense the variance they need to try and get you off the field do.
Yeah, the 10-yard holding penalty is a drive killer. I mean, it's not quite as bad as a sack, but it's almost up there with the ability to kind of just like completely bury potentially, you know, good drive. And we've seen that at times this year. But thankfully, I think I don't have the numbers right in front of me. It seems like most of the penalties have been defense in terms of the big ones. There have been offensive penalties. You know, Patrick McCarry in particular has been been kind of an issue in that realm, but a lot of them have been the 5-yard varieties of the illegal man downfield. There's been a lot of those on the Ravens.
That's
this year.
A costly penalty.
It is a costly penalty, but it's not as costly as a 10-yard penalty, or the, you know, sometimes the ones that give big chunks of yards, like the personal fouls that we saw this past game.
Yes, sir. Completely agree. we talked a little bit in the production meeting about the negativity generally of fans right now. And there seems to be, you know, I think it's always kind of a vocal minority. It's the same thing. I think the Fire Harbaugh people are actually a vocal minority, but I'm just talking, forget the Fire Harbaugh stuff for a minute. What do you think about this team, you know, potentially winning the Super Bowl? If you can't be happy about the Ravens' chances, I mean, they were better last year. They were better last year. They towered over the league in a way that was even more extreme last year. But they're number one in DVOA again. Okay, right now. And if you can't get happy about this team and their prospects to win the Super Bowl, even though they have to play some games on the road, yeah, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I think the main reason why they're not a betting favorite right now is because of the record and the fact that they won't have the first round bye or second round bye. I think in terms of their performance on the field, they're still being seen as a top probably 2 to 3 team in the NFL. If you look at the betting markets, you know, I think they're going into this next week game against Pittsburgh as a 6.5-point favorite, which is a pretty significant number against a team that has a better record than them. So, you know, it's interesting to see how sometimes some of those numbers work, but I think this team is probably, you know, if not the best team in the NFL, top 3 team for sure. We already talked about the health, that is a huge factor there. You know, some of the better teams in the NFC, like the Lions, have been crushed by injuries this year, and mm-hmm. it's hard to see, you know, them actually getting through a full playoffs, even if they get a bye because of that. It's something that's very difficult to overcome just from a depth standpoint. And the Ravens, I think every loss this year has been a one score loss. You know, they've been very close.
It's been more than 3 years since they lost by more than a score with Lamar Jackson at quarterback. So the last time they did it was that horrible Dolphins game with the 40 cover zero looks.
Yeah. So like, I mean, they're an extremely competitive game. I think small plays could have easily, you know, changed the outcome of multiple of these games this year. I think any Ravens fan would agree with that. So I understand why it's frustrating to kind of not trust in the team because they haven't been able to always close out in those close games. But on the other side of it, they're still playing, you know, extremely good football. And they have shown that when they are clicking and they are putting it together, it's one of the clearly, you know, premier teams in the league. And to me, it's just, can they put it together for that string of games? And I think we'll learn a lot as the season unfolds. We have 3 more games. If they win all 3, they're going to be in great shape. Basically win every game from here on out. And that's your key to success. I mean, if you lose a game, you'll lose a standing in terms of where you are in the final seeding. But if they win these 3 games, that gives me a lot of confidence in how they're going to go into the postseason, because these are, at least 2 of them are going to be against playoff caliber teams. So that kind of is a benchmark for where you want to be moving into the really tough games.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they do win those 3 games, I think not only will they jump to more than a 50% chance to win the division, because I think the Steelers getting through their last 2 games will be a little bit tough for them. Yeah. They've got Kansas City on a short week. It will be at home, but they've got them on a short week. And then they'll have Cincinnati also at home. So they'll have to win one of those 2 games. It's certainly not a given. And I think they probably slightly more likely than not to lose a game of those last 2. It is interesting because the Chiefs are an underdog at Houston this week. If Houston were to win that game, it would not have a negative impact on the Ravens for multiple reasons, I think. Number one is, and it's really those more to relate to the wild card. Number one is that the Texans would clinch the AFC South, so they'll be unmotivated potentially for their Week 17 game against the Ravens. That's a very big deal on a short week. The notion that the Texans might think about resting some players against the Ravens, which would be that, boy, would that be great. And then possibility number 2 is, and all it takes is some marginal decisions, you know, some players who are just on the margin in terms of injury. They are like, well, we'll hold them out. We got the division 1. We're guaranteed the 4 seed. Why bother? You know, kind of thing. The other possibility is that if Kansas City were to lose a game, then that will help because their week 18 game against Denver, who could potentially drop the Ravens down a slot in the wild card standings, could be a big motivational shift. And if Kansas City knows just exactly how to tank a game that they don't really care about, So if they've got the one seed locked up, they're not going to try at all against Denver. And I'm afraid that might happen. I'm not that afraid because it'll mean they beat Pittsburgh, but it could happen. And if it does, it wouldn't be entirely ideal.
Yeah. It'll have to depend on getting some help, but I feel good. I mean, this isn't a look ahead necessarily podcast, but I feel good about the Ravens against the Steelers at home. Mm-hmm. And I also feel, you know, good that the Steelers will lose another game. So to me, I think it's likely that the Ravens win the division and end up with a 3 seed. But we'll see what happens. And it'll be interesting to be in that position of having the 3 seed, because I think it, you know, might be an interesting, you know, wild card and potentially, you know, follow-up divisional round matchups, depending on how the seeding folds out. So there's a lot that could still in the works in terms of how it could go in a lot of different directions. But I honestly think the Ravens are in not the, you know, best shape. It would be much nicer if they had, you know, two less losses, but I think that they clearly have a path forward. There's no other team in the AFC that I think is a complete juggernaut at this time. Everybody's beatable. So if they play their best game, I feel confident in them.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. My primary concern is the weather in January and how it will impact the passing game. Mm-hmm. And that could hurt them both in Buffalo and in Kansas City. And that's my primary fear. People say, yeah, no problem. Derrick Henry will run the ball. That's not how the Ravens offense works. They don't have a particularly great offensive line. They have just a middle of the pack offensive line. And they depend on the misdirection and the Lamar Henry mesh point, the play action fueling the running game, as well as the passing game. They depend on all that. They depend on the ability to continue to be able to make whatever decision they want to, pre-snap and post-snap. And it's just not, for their offense to be optimal, for their offense to be the advantage that it is right now, as Devoa, for instance, would say it, they really need to have not terrible weather conditions. It is a big reason why, if that first game is at Houston, if they're going to be the wild card, that's the place they want to play.
Makes sense.
All right, two other things before we get on to some other topics. Deontay Johnson and the OBJ, the musings over them. Deontay Johnson, percentage chance from your perspective, he's played his last meaningful snap as a Raven.
100%.
Okay, I'm close. And OBJ, any reason why the Ravens should consider picking him up at this point, particularly after Walker's successes last week?
I would say that I would rather have him on the roster than Deontay Johnson. I think that potentially there is a depth problem if Aguilar is not 100%. They don't have a wide receiver 3 with a lot of experience. And if something were to happen to Bateman again or to Flowers, all of a sudden the depth at wide receiver becomes a little bit questionable. So for that reason, I wouldn't mind bringing Beckham back in. I think he kind of got a bad rap for a couple of reasons last year. One, he didn't live up to the contract that he was given. Two, his numbers were not as, you know, as big as what people had hoped for. On the other hand of that, he had actually very good efficiency numbers.
Yeah, per target, he was good.
Yeah, yard per target. He led the team, I think, yards for not led the team, he led the wide receivers. Mm-hmm. Yards per route run, he was quite good. He made clutch catches for the team. He was very good in that. And I think he was actually a locker room leader. He wasn't a cancer at all. He wasn't a problem. He was mature. He brought leadership. And I think he comes into it with a humility as opposed to being someone who feels like he needs to get the targets like what Johnson felt like when he came in.
Yeah, I mean, he's playing for survival in this league, frankly, OBJ is, in terms of is there any future for him? And he's going to need to be happy with 6 snaps, 8 snaps, 12 snaps, whatever they carve out for him. He's certainly not ahead of either of the other guys the Ravens have right now in terms of Flowers or Bateman. There's no way he should be taking snaps away from those guys. But he's also been terrible for the Dolphins this year. I'm just utterly terrible. And Tua overall is having a good year, 107 rating. I mean, he didn't play all the snaps with Tua. There were other quarterbacks involved. And some of that was Tyler Huntley throwing to him. We know that's probably not going to work out, but he also can't make excuses for 3.1 yards per target and all the other terrible things. He hasn't forced a missed tackle all year. I think he was 1 of 5 on contested catches. I mean, just every stat he's got is terrible across the board in terms of what he did for Miami this year.
Yeah, I mean, there really isn't any argument to kind of go against that. Clearly, I don't think it was a good fit. You know, Miami doesn't really play many three wide receiver sets. Obviously, you know, he started the season injured. There was a lot of turnover there in terms of quarterbacks. It's kind of an ugly season overall for Miami, so maybe just wasn't the best fit to start. But he played in this system here in Baltimore last year. He's familiar with it. He's familiar with the players. He's familiar with the locker room. And if there is a position on the team right now that needs depth, wide receiver is definitely one of them. So for that reason, I wouldn't be opposed to it. I don't think they need to necessarily go out and get him, but if they made that move, it wouldn't be a bad thing in my mind.
Okay. So they'd be signing him for the vet minimum if they did.
Right.
I'm not excited about it. I think I'd rather see a creative solution. And the one I've been thinking about a little bit is, a lot of this depends on how healthy Keaton Mitchell is. Part of what happened this last week, Keaton Mitchell didn't play, of course, again, was inactive again. Rasheen Ali got some carries, which was unusual for the Ravens to get RB3 carries. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But Keaton Mitchell, I think, could be a slot receiver used on this team. Could run some routes, certainly, but could also do a lot of the gadget plays from that spot where he's crossing the formation and misdirecting. And I think you really want a high value breakaway threat taking that exact job. And Deontay Johnson maybe could have been it, but he didn't want the job. And Keaton Mitchell of 2023 would be much better than Deontay Johnson of any year in terms of doing that job. And I also think he can give you something as a receiver, but mostly I think he gives you tremendous misdirection. And then you know what? You don't have to use Zay Flowers. You don't have to bring Zay Flowers into an orbit. You don't have to do that. You can concentrate on Zay Flowers peeling a safety like he did so effectively this last week.
I think that could be an effective way to use Keaton Mitchell. Clearly, you know, the speed and explosiveness is something that is beneficial to have on the field. I don't know off the top of my head what he kind of looks like in terms of a route runner, in terms of like his ability to catch the ball. I think, you know, he had fairly limited opportunities last year as a pass catcher. I want to say it's something he could definitely, you know, at least be a decoy in that sense, and potentially have some gravity and use him on the field in like pony packages, like you said. Yeah. Not necessarily as a true running back. So that could make sense as an alternative. And I think that, you know, just having another explosive weapon will be beneficial for the team.
I mean, he was used on some wheel routes last year, one at least that I think I can remember, and a lot of plays that were more or less an extension of the run game, this kind of jet toss kind of plays. But he had, you know, 9 targets for 93 yards. So he's up there over 10 yards a target last year. I don't think he's the same player, but part of what makes me think he was held out of this last game was the MetLife turf, that they didn't want to risk that on it. So I'm hoping that one of these next 2 weeks, we're going to see the beginning of the Keaton Mitchell story. And it's going to be something that is 2 to 4 plays a game of hopefully impactful misdirection or touches, actually.
Yeah, it is a little bit surprising because he did come back for a game and had some touches. And then pretty much after that, he was...
Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
231. That's the average number of apps used by many companies. This leads to a lot of context switching that can distract employees and costs your company. Luckily, Grammarly can help. Grammarly's AI works in over 500,000 apps and websites, making it easy for your team to crank out clear, on-brand emails, documents, messages, and more. In just one click, they can go from blank page to first draft, all without leaving the page they're on. Grammarly has 15 years of experience building effective, secure AI that can be implemented in days with minimal IT overhead. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences, whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon. Join 70,000 teams who save an average of $5,000 per employee per year using Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Only special teams, and then there was nothing. And then he became inactive. So I am curious if it's if that's a health issue or if they just didn't see something that they wanted to see. So I think he could be potentially a wild card for the team. If he is, you know, healthy and they find a role for him. So I am curious to see what develops on that end, because, you know, we saw the talent last year. It's clear when he has the ball in his hands, what he can do. And even if he's not that, you know, 100% back, he's still more explosive than the vast majority of the players around the NFL.
Yeah. All right. Got one more topic to hit on very briefly. I'm starting to get, the first communications from Jets podcasters who have heard Todd Monken come up as a potential hire for the Jets job. Now, they don't have the Joe Douglas connection anymore, but Monken is still a hot coordinator. Certainly the Ravens offense will be a look at this. Monken does not seem like an obvious hire because he's not a dynasty hire at his age. He's a guy who's there for a couple of years. You know, maybe he could coach for another 4 to 6 years as a head coach and call the plays offensively for somebody. But I think there's a pretty good chance he's going to start getting some interviews this year anyway. How do you feel about the risk of losing Monken? And you know, I have a follow-up question for that in terms of the institutional knowledge that they kept from the Greg Roman era effectively. You know, they got a lot of same players.
Yeah.
You think they could keep some of that from the Monken passing game and bring in somebody new who would layer on new characteristics?
I think they definitely could if he decided to move on and take a head coaching opportunity. Obviously, you know, the playbook is p- part of the, what the Ravens' identity is. You know, they have a lot of those plays that they'll be running. I would imagine there are, I mean, they have players, I think, in the coaching on the offensive side who they can promote. That I'm less concerned about. I don't think it'll be the same type of situation that we had last year with the whole defense of coaching staff leaving and then kind of like leaving a massive void. I think there are players that can be promoted from within that probably aren't going to be getting offensive coordinator positions in other locations. But because they've been in the team a couple years, they have, you know, experience within the system and an ability to kind of take on that style of play calling. I mean, you're mostly just losing the experience mm-hmm. of someone like Amonkhan, who's been an offensive coordinator, offensive coach for a very long time, both at the collegiate and the NFL level. I think that's what a lot of times when new coordinators who are first time in that role of having to call the plays, that's where we see the biggest kind of potential issues is not having that feel for like being able to like, you know, have like the correct sequencing of plays and understanding the cadence and the tenor of what's happening and making sure that, you know, the right play is called in that environment, because they've been there before. They've been in these situations and they know exactly kind of like what you go to, and you get the pulse of how your players are performing. I think that comes with experience. I think that's the main thing you lose by someone like Monken who would be leaving.
Well, we've certainly, even though Zach Orr had been here, you know, kind of learning or being around anyway, what McDonald was doing. I don't know to what degree he was, you know, contributing to it more directly as a linebackers coach. He's had his struggles getting up to speed. I think, you know, we won't talk about this because it's a defensive show. We'll leave it for that. But I do think they could probably retain a lot of what Monken has layered in here. And then you bring in the next offensive coordinator. I don't think he's a slam dunk, by the way, Monken gets taken by anybody. I thought McDonald was a higher probability, and McDonald waited till the last available hire. You know, he was the Seahawks got him, and everybody else had filled their role, had filled their job. So, you know, with Monken, it could be the same kind of situation. He's not a A-plus candidate because he's not a dynasty head coach. You know, you're not getting a 38-year-old or a 36-year-old who you want to have for 25 years. You're getting a guy who's, you know, more limited in terms of the amount of time you have. So if the Ravens lose him, it'd be sad. They'd have to go out and fight again. But I already think the Ravens are going to have to go through a massive coaching overhaul this offseason in terms of the positional ranks to make sure that they've got the succession plans in place all across the organization. And that means succession plans for both defensive and offensive coordinators, but it also means a succession plan for Harbaugh. That, you know, you're at the point now with probably 5 to 8 years left where you ought to be thinking about, okay, which guys in my organization might be that guy in the future. Mm-hmm. If you had an Anthony Weaver of 5 years ago, that might be the guy you'd be planning on right now being the Harbaugh's replacement.
Yeah, that I think that makes a lot of sense. And you probably want someone who's been in the building for a number of years already, who you have a good sense of who they are and what they bring to the table.
You think at the coordinator or your ultimate head coaching tabby?
I think first you would want to have someone. I mean, you don't necessarily have to bring a coordinator who's been within the system. I think that's probably what they would do. I would imagine T. Martin would be kind of the first person to look at in terms of taking an potential role as offensive coordinator. I'm sure they would, you know, interview other candidates as well. But for a head coaching position, I think you do want someone. For the most part, for the team like the Ravens, they want somebody who's probably been with the team. But I could be wrong about that. And it might depend on who's available outside as well. But that tends to be what I would expect. Just the way that this whole, you know, kind of, it's not really a dynasty, but how the team's run itself over the past, you know, close to two decades now with Harbaugh. They've really built a lot of kind of continuity in all aspects of the way they're building a team, and that includes the coaching staff.
And the reason coaching trees exist is because coaches are successful.
Right.
You know, if you're successful, you don't leave the head coaching ranks. Your people leave from out from under you, and it's kind of like losing any free agent. It's heartbreaking to lose your really good people like McDonald. but it's part of the process. If you want to be a great football team year after year after year, you're going to have coordinator successes and those guys are going to move on. And it's just tough crap and part of the game. And it does mean you need to continually be resorting. But I want to go back specifically to the McDonald's situation, because if you're looking at a five-year plan to replace Harbaugh, you got time to A, get the next Mike McDonald in the building to be your linebackers coach or whatever it might be for 2 years. Then if you're defensive coordinator, you're still happy with this, or you got time to farm him out to Michigan again for a year, if that's what you want to do. And the connection is not there maybe in the same way, but where whatever college program you know people at, you send your stud guy to that program to be their defensive coordinator for a year, so he gets experience at play calling. Then you bring him back, you know, to be either the defensive coordinator or a linebackers coach again. Then you promote him to the defensive coordinator. Then you promote him to be the head coach of the team. There's time for all of that, you know, within a 5-year plan to replace Harbaugh, if you even thought it was necessary to do it in that time. And by the way, that's an option on a 5-year plan. You don't have to pull the trigger at the end of that time, and you might be able to pull the trigger before that if you really needed to. So I just think, you know, the notion that, boy, this next move better work because we've got to get Harbaugh out of there because we want a guy who calls plays on one side of the ball and that's it. I think it's kind of too early to be already thinking about that. It's always the right time to be thinking about succession planning, but it's not the right time to be thinking about 2025 or 26 succession planning, because that ain't happening, folks.
Yeah, I would be really surprised if Harbaugh stepped away. He's not going to get fired.
Yep.
I would be really surprised if he stepped away from the team at this point. So it would probably have to be something personal that came up. My guess would be, but I mean, I can't obviously speak for him, but he doesn't ever give me the sense that he's ready to walk away from coaching anytime soon. So
it's exactly the sense I have that there's no imminent. The other thing is, just look at John Harbaugh. The guy is unnaturally young. You know, the thing that this reminds me of is kind of the way that it's described that Bilbo Baggins ages in The Lord of the Rings. Once he gets the ring, he's just look at his brother, and he looks 10 years older than him now. I think he's 2 years younger or something. It's just a weird situation.
I think it's the Lamar Jackson effect.
Could be. He smiles a whole lot. He should have some wrinkles, though, you would think, but whatever. Let's move on a little bit, talk about the offense more generally. They lost the snap count 60-59. That's going to happen in games where you have explosive offensive plays that are getting down the field pretty quickly, and the other team is scrambling, getting some penalty first downs, but they're scrambling to make 10 yards on three plays. And they ended up, you know, winning yardage by almost a 2-1 margin, yet losing snap count 60-59. And the other thing that fell into that was, as the game ended with two drives of not trying anything tricky, you know, they converted what, one of three series for a first down, I believe that's correct.
At the end of the game, you mean?
Yeah. So, you know, they're gonna get slowed down a little bit on that. Maybe it's two out of four, but maybe it's two out of three even. But they did fail one third down with Johnson in the game. The other thing that contributed to it is something I want to spend a little bit of time on, which is the failed fourth and one early in the game. Now, for those who don't know, Gabe's a PhD in microbiology.
Close enough. Yeah, close.
I always get this wrong, but I always say that, I think, and then you correct me. But anyway, it's close enough. I'm gonna try and do this with as light a math touch as I can. And I realize there's a very significant STEM audience out there who will be able to follow along with this. And I'm counting on Gabe to basically ask me questions when things don't seem to be explained well, because the math is, I'm sure, very simple to him. And it's very understandable to, I think, most people. But why was that fourth and one such a bad decision is really the thing. And Harbaugh just explained it after. We just decided we were going to try and punt in those kind of situations. That's really, I'm sure his analytics people told him different on the headset at the time. But the Ben Baldwin bot is a good starting point for a lot of these things. If you don't know it, Ben_Baldwin_bot on, or maybe it's Ben Bot Baldwin on Twitter. If you look for that, it has every fourth down that comes up across the NFL. It's kind of the red zone of fourth down opportunities. It'll tell you what the odds are on the play and things like that. So this particular play came out, and the Ravens were basically betting a very small amount. Now, the score is no score in the game. If they had made the first down in that play, they had a 90% chance to win the game. If they miss it, they had a 79% chance to win the game. Okay, so it's only 11% of the game is actually in play. If you think about it, 11% of the win is in play on that game. And I don't want to get in too much to what 11% of the game means, because obviously there's pluses and minuses you can have in each direction for an entire game that would add up to more than 100 either way, potentially. But this is 11% of the game that was in play here. By punting, Harbaugh said effectively, you know what? I see 79 as a possibility. I see 90 as a possibility. Tell you what, just give me 82% chance to win the game. And that's what their chance was with the punt. That's what their punt reduced their chances to. Now, if you think about that for a moment, you have 11% of the win probability in play. You give up that chance at 11% in exchange for 3%. Okay, basically you're saying, if I have a 3/11 chance to make that first down, I break even on it. 3/11, that's 27.3%. The model said their chance was 73%. To make that first down. I think that might be low given the relative trench sizes and health of these teams right now. And also the misdirection that Jackson can throw at you and whatnot, but you know, let's say it's correct. It's 73%. That still makes it a bad decision by about 47 percentage points of that 11%. And sure enough, it comes out, there's rounding involved in those numbers, but it comes out to be exactly 4.7% that the Ravens gave up in terms of total win probability by doing that. They had a 73% chance, and they said, you know what? I'm happy if we just play like it was a 27% chance, and I took the value from that. It did not make any sense at all. And it's one of the reasons why I'm commonly heard making comments about how mathematicians are never very impressed with the way that head coaches make decisions in the NFL.
I think the biggest complicating factor from the more and the reason why people who tend to be more conservative in how they see these types of decisions is let me see if I can get the wording on this right. They overestimate how negative a turnover on downs is in these situations. If you turn the ball over, let's say at midfield, because you failed to convert, you give them the ball, maybe they score a touchdown. Most likely they don't. More likely that they score a field goal, definitely, because they have good field position. When your team is the significant favorite, which they were in this outcome, and this is why the numbers you're talking about, you know, like an 82% chance of winning even with the punt, but because the Ravens are significant favorites to win this. So you go ahead and say, the worst case scenario is, you know, we give them the ball in good field position. We still have a very high chance of winning this. The positive outcome of this, you convert, you're basically guaranteed points if you do that, based on how the Ravens have been moving the ball on the first drive. They kind of had an unlucky play on third down that led to having to go for on fourth down. They're a team that is expected to be able to move the ball well. I mean, like we've talked about this podcast, they're one of the best, if not the best offense in football. They should be able to move the ball if they get the first down here. So you're kind of going from close to guaranteeing a win if they go for it and make it, to still a very good position, even if they lose it, to, and the chance of that happening, of not converting, is marginal. So it's just a severe conservative decision that it ended up working out, right? Like, but
Really.
Well, I mean, they won the game, so I'll say they worked out. Sure. But it's not like they probably could have had a better overall outcome all in the game, larger margin of victory had they gone for it there.
Yeah,
I will say that.
Okay, so it was. I think, you know, one of the reasons is snap count related. That you lose control of the football, you're not able to grind the clock. That was the 2019 Ravens' complete MO. They went for it on fourth down, whenever they felt like it, with almost impunity, getting it done correctly, or they certainly had very high success rate going for it on fourth down, it led to them winning offensive snap count by wide margins a lot. Now, they have an explosive offense right now, but you know, to lose the snap count 60-59 to the Giants, they had to help the Giants out in some ways also. One was not going for it on fourth down. The other one was, of course, two drives at the end where they're basically just trying to run out the clock. I'm really bothered by one element of this that I'll say that I think is different from other people. When you punt, you're not avoiding risk. There are risks in every single decision that you make, whether you choose to punt, to kick a field goal, to go for it. All of those potential outcomes from those plays have risk. So don't tell me a punt is riskless. And don't even tell me a punt is a lower risk play. It's a lower value play. It's a high risk play in point of fact, because it's extremely cowardly in terms of the win probability lost. And it was risky in terms of the 4.7 percentage points of win probability they gave up in this game at that exact moment. And that's why I really don't like pretending like a punt is a low risk play. It is not. And I also don't believe anymore in the NFL that coaches are being judged on fourth and one decisions negatively in terms of their job. That might have been true. The fourth and one from their own 16 could have been something that would have been, even though it's an outstanding, obvious play from an analytic standpoint, 2.7%, or I think it's 2.3% actually in that case, of additional win probability from doing it. But if you know, 20 years ago, that would have been a more difficult sale, and a coach might have actually taken some heat for making that decision. And you know, you have a big, if you're Bill Belichick and you have a big amount of currency in the bank with your owner, you're not at risk of getting fired. If you're John Harbaugh, probably the same thing. But you know, you really are. I think in today's game, coaches are not judged negatively in that way. I think analytics are already pushing everything in that direction. Mathematicians basically are controlling the game in a lot of ways from a game management standpoint. And I think it's the coaches who stay with the Tomlin-esque cowardly punting routine and what Harbaugh did in this game, I think are going to fall by the wayside in terms of their ability to maintain head coaching jobs.
I think that we have gotten to that point where more people are willing to look at the numbers, look at the math, and say what actually, you know, is going to give your team the best chance of winning is often going for it. And I think that was something that was mentioned in the broadcast, right? That they were expecting the Ravens to go for it.
Yeah.
Because they'd basically gone for fourth and one every single opportunity they had all year, and they were surprised in this one that they didn't. I think I was definitely surprised. they even lined up to go for it and then decided that they're just going to try to get the jump offsides play. So it was definitely, you know, a shock to me. I was 100% expecting them to make that call to go for it.
I'll toss in one more thing. The relationship you want to look for in terms of how much potential gain, how much expected gain do you have there, which was 4.7 percentage points again, you should be dividing it by some measure of risk or variance or even standard deviation. In this case, there's only an 11% total amount in play of that. Having a 4.7 percentage point edge on something where it's only 11 points in play is kind of like putting the other person, being the dealer at blackjack when the player has 16 against your 10 card. He's got about a 1 in 4 chance to win. I mean, you have about a 50% edge on the bet. Just it's absurdly advantageous, and the Ravens didn't press that edge. And I'm you know, it's something I probably won't get unbothered by. When things like this come up, particularly midfield plus territory like it was there, it's not something I'm okay with.
Yeah, and hopefully it's not, you know, a sign of conservative calls in, you know, the rest of the season, playoffs. Mm-hmm. I imagine the call was made because Harbaugh felt like they were going to be such heavy favorites that they didn't want to risk, you know, the negative outcome in that situation, that they were just going to play defense and get the ball back. In closer games and against more important or more stronger opponents, this type of decision could cost them.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about a few other things. I'm going to just cut some things here that we had planned to talk about. A few things about the receivers. I mean, we know the efficient offense and what that was. Efficient receivers were impressive in terms of their catch rate. And that doesn't always go with this next thing I'm going to give you. There was only 114 of 290 yards passing were yak in this game. So that means Lamar was getting most of his total passing yards as air yards. Okay. And it's very high figure to have 61% of your yards come from air yards. For the season, the Ravens were almost exactly 50-50, about 49% were air yards for the year. So that's a really exceptional total.
Yeah, and even I think one of the touchdowns, the one that Justice Hill was a lot of yards after the catch. But he definitely seemed to be looking downfield a lot in this one. You know, Bateman, both of his touchdowns, I think, were probably 20 plus yards, mm-hmm. or close to. The second one might not have been, but it was a lot of, you know, intentionally trying to find receivers down the field. And the big play to Bateman that was not caught, the deep throw where he was open, another deep target. So there was definitely an intent going into this game where they felt like they could take advantage of something that they were seeing probably on film from the Giants. And they had a game plan in which to attack that.
Walker was 21 of 21 yards, I think, in the air, and Andrews was 13 of 13 yards in the air. So, I mean, they had several throws in the end zone. I was actually wrong. The first Bateman throw was what, about the 8-yard line or something, and then he juked a couple players and got in. But most of that was in the air. The other thing the Ravens did well is they forced a lot of missed tackles in this game. 14 missed tackles, a 19.2% missed tackle rate by the Giants in this game, which is very high. And that's exactly what you should do. The true nature of the Baltimore Ravens, you probably heard me say this on the pod before this year, if you're out there listening, is to force missed tackles between your receivers, who are very elusive and jukey, and your primary running back, who is a workhorse tackle breaking against smaller man, stiff army monster. You really, you know, those assets, you should be using them to force missed tackles. If you're not, it's really not a very good thing. But the Giants in this game did have a lot of trouble getting the Ravens on the ground.
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime you have someone like, say, Flowers as such a threat with the ball in his hands, he's going to make some people miss tackles. And Bateman also was good in this game, yard after the catch. I think it was a shorter mm-hmm. pass where he showed his ability, and then also on the touchdown. Yep. He made a couple of players miss. They could have brought him down right before he got into the end zone on his first touchdown.
Yeah, the pass where he got the first down and he was maybe 8 yards short of the stick or something when he caught the ball, or might even been a little more than that. That was impressive. And it was sad to see Bateman not have the good throws made on all five. If he'd gotten, you know, this would have been one of those games we'd have really remembered in Ravens history for a receiver. If he'd have gotten, probably might have been a third touchdown mm-hmm. on the deep ball. So then you're already talking about the Ishmael game and a few others where receivers have been that outstanding. And if he had caught five out of five for, you know, probably would have been about 130 to 140 yards. We're talking about this game with a different kind of irreverence and I think it changes some of the narrative about Rashad Bateman. I literally saw somebody on the internet arguing that what Bateman really should have done is come back for the football, fight the defender off it, make sure it was no chance of interception, and while you're at it, go ahead and catch that ball. Please.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some people who still want to be critical of him. I understand that the first three seasons in Baltimore weren't the most optimal, most ideal, but he's become one of the, you know, better number two wide receivers in the NFL this year, if you even want to, you know, call him that. In some games, he's playing like the number one for this team.
Why does that matter? Why does the number one or number two definition matter? Well, he's making a ridiculously small amount of money for a wide receiver on a second contract. He's one of the most valuable single contracts at wide receiver in the entire NFL. I think that's his draft position no longer matters for anything, because all fifth-year option and the second contract, all that's been resolved. And the only thing that is we're left with is we've got Bateman for two more years on an incredibly cheap deal, where he looks like the real deal in terms of being a very useful receiving threat for Lamar Jackson and the Baltimore Ravens.
Yeah, and he's still only 25 years old. You know, he's not like an older receiver. He came into the league relatively young. He still has, you know, potential room to grow in this offense. Mm-hmm. If he can stay healthy, I think he's going to be a dynamic playmaker for this team, hopefully for years to come.
Talk about a few more Lamar things here, and then we'll close this first segment out. We'll come back and we'll start off with some other scheme stuff in the second one. They used a very vanilla rush. The Giants said they blitzed some, but they primarily were using numbers to get to Lamar. So they had 12 four-man rushes, 12 five-man rushes, and 4 6-man rushes. Lamar was very effective basically versus everything, 11.8 yards per play against the four-man rush, 9.4 against the five-man rush, which is the bulk of those. He was sacked twice. Actually, he was sacked once, and Johnson was sacked once with a 6-man rush. So that ended up being worth about 8 yards per play, actually, when Lamar was in there. They were 8 of 9. Sorry, do I have that correct? I believe that's correct. 8 of 9 on third down with Lamar Jackson in the game. 8 of 9. Okay, doesn't happen very often, and they moved up to second in the entire NFL in terms of third down percentage with the game yesterday.
Yeah, I guess the only third down they didn't convert on was the one that preceded the fourth down decision.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that was just a coming up short of the line to gain with an attempt to extend the ball. So ample time and space, ball out quick and pressure. Let's divide all the passing attempts for Lamar. And again, I don't really care about the one attempt for Johnson. 12 ATS opportunities. That's 44% of the total. That's absolutely outstanding. Really, we're going to get the grades in the second half about the offensive line. And they look pretty good largely because of this. Had 9 of 12 of those passes completed for 148 yards. So that's 12.3 yards per play when they gave him 3 seconds to throw. No problem with that. It's 4 yards better than your average.
It's fantastic.
It's fantastic. 7 times ball out quick, 26%. Not even a whole lot for a game that would be typical. He went 7 for 7 on those throws for 70 yards, 10.0 yards per play. A typical amount might be about 6. Again, 4 yards per play better than expectation for those throws.
I mean, it was really just an outstanding performance. I think we're seeing that clearly. When you dive into the numbers, no matter which way you cut it.
That's what I'm trying to get to here with this third one here, is that there are 8 pressure events, 30% of those on which he completed 5 of 6 for 72 yards. And one of the big plays in there was the play to Hill was a pressure event. So 7.8 yards per play on that, 3.5 would be the normal standard for those plays. And so even with the 2 sacks that occurred on those, he's still 4 yards above average on that set as well. An incredible drumbeat-like consistency of above-averageness for Lamar Jackson, this regardless of what his offensive line did for him. And in total, he outperformed his expectation by 108 yards, which happens to be exactly 4.0 yards per play above expectation on his 27 plays that result in a pass or sack.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. He definitely had one of his better games of the season. He looked completely locked in. Accurate with passing. I think there was some whispers that maybe he had been playing a little bit beat up in the previous weeks leading up to the bye, which, you know, it's not completely out of the ordinary to have players who are not 100%. Maybe he was missing a couple throws that he would normally make. That wasn't the case this week. I think you mentioned the one big miss to Bateman where he underthrew him. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, he seemed just completely locked in. The throw to Bateman, the second touchdown, was one of the best throws he's made all season.
And how about the Walker throw? I mean, nice low trajectory on that, yeah.
And even the one to Mark Andrews, where he put it right behind the defender's like helmet because he knew where the route was going to be. It was an interesting little play design where Andrews kind of faked a short route and then kind of went upfield and was. Open, but only open because of the way that the defender wasn't paying attention to him, or I think Lamar probably had him juked.
So if you look at that play, Isaiah Simmons is a defender. He's a linebacker and a pretty good young linebacker at that, but Andrews cut into the end zone. Simmons was stumbled for a second, got up and tried to get back to the play. So he's scrambling like crazy. And effectively, we've seen this all year with 21 on the left sideline from the offense's perspective, having trouble with the back shoulder throw. He couldn't get his head around to look for the football because he had to find Andrews again. Andrews presented himself very well to Lamar, but didn't put his hands up until it was too late for Simmons to do anything about it. And then, of course, the ball's in Andrew's hands, and it's right by. Like, I love the play from both of their perspectives, like, on that. But Jackson is a true miracle worker, with understanding the opportunity being there with a back shoulder, seeing the back of the jersey of a player.
Yeah, and that ball was a tight window throw. I mean, there wasn't a huge, you know, wide open lay in. That was also a very low angle trajectory throw where he really zipped it in there, but exactly where it had to be.
Quickly, any issue with the Ravens running back snap division, anything like that? I haven't heard one complaint about, you know, overworking Henry, or, you know, why the hell do we need Ali in there, or any of that stuff. Any thoughts?
I think it was smart to give Ali some touches at the end of the game. There's no reason to keep Henry out there. The game was well out of hand at that point. And we're getting to that point of the year where you want to have him 100% fresh for the playoffs. So, yeah, give Elise some run. You know, get him some reps. You never know what you might need from him down the road. So, getting him that in-game experience, I think, is really good. Even with having him in there for the final couple drives, I think, you know, the Ravens still managed 7.5 points per play on the game. Just goes to show how dominant they were when their starters were in there.
Yeah, him with that backup offensive line, backup quarterback, no threat of passing the ball, getting, you know, 32 yards on 8 carries is really remarkable. That's, you know, that's 4.0 yards per carry. It's very difficult to do when the opponent knows exactly what's coming, and he certainly did in that case. I love getting Ali in there, and I think that we might see Mitchell again still. But it's good to see, you know, what you got a little bit with Ali. The thing I'll say about Henry is I'm really happy, I think, from the team's perspective, that he didn't make a run at 2,000 yards this year. That's just something that it would have been a not meaningful milestone in terms of the franchise winning the Super Bowl, and it could have been distracting to how things have gone. So I'm he's been terrific. He's tremendously valuable, and Lamar Henry mesh point, that's the greatest single weapon in the entire NFL. But it doesn't need 2,000 yards attached to it to have that value.
Yeah.
All right. We'll get into some of the other things in the second half of the show. Gabe, it's always a pleasure to talk football with you. Can you tell folks where they can contact you online and talk football, or where else you may be posting some things of interest?
Yeah. I mean, I'm on Twitter. I feel like I mostly still probably post to Twitter at Gabe Fergie there. Also on Blue Sky, if some of you who might have migrated over there, I have the same handle on Blue Sky. I'm not quite as active there. I see some people posting on both. I don't have the time to do that. So it just depends on kind of where I'm looking. But I think you know, interacting on social media is probably the best way to get in touch with me right now.
All right, he's at Gabe Fergie, and make sure you give him a follow and tag him in if that's not going to be a bother to you. Sometimes I know it's possible to mute a conversation. Sometimes you get in these, for better lack of better words, dick wagging contests between fans that, you know, think that usually it's Lamar Jackson versus Josh Allen is being discussed. And I don't want to be any part of that. And so you do have the option to leave the conversation or mute it or whatever. But anyway, Gabe is a great guy to tag in on that selected topic that you think he might have some understanding of. And that's a lot of football. So make sure you get him in there. Other folks out there, thanks for listening in. Please like and subscribe if you're on YouTube. If you're just a normal podcast follower, show this podcast to one other person. We'll be eternally grateful for the word of mouth, which has been most of the growth of the show over the years. Gabe, thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. Always a pleasure.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.